The song called Whole Life, recorded in 2003, has never been released on a Paul McCartney album. That's McCartney collaborating with guitarist Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics. Great song. We're talking with musician, vocalist Tom DeLonge, who's still making music these days with his band Angels and Airwaves, but also has a lot more on his plate. The umbrella title for this multi-platform project is Secret Machines, the first of many books in the series. Secret Machines, Chasing Shadows is available now, co-written by A.J. Hartley, who will join us in just a moment to talk about the process. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program. A.J. Hartley is the international best-selling author of 14 novels, including the new one, Secret Machines, Chasing Shadows, co-written with my guest, Tom DeLonge. A.J. Hartley is a distinguished professor of Shakespeare at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, George.
I guess the obvious question is, what's a distinguished guy like you doing in company like this talking about UFOs?
That's a great question. I sometimes wonder. But, you know, I think these are the kind of questions that that people want to talk about. And my work as a Shakespearean has always been committed to the idea that that Shakespeare was involved in the kind of stories that that his audience wanted to hear, and the questions that he wanted to talk about, the people he wanted to talk about, and that's always been my way in, to try and write stories, to come up with the kind of drama that people just want to hear.
Tom, what was the pitch you made to him, and why did you pick AJ?
Well, you know, it's easy to pick the guy because he's an incredible, incredible novelist. He's a very elevated writer. I think when you look at his body of work and look at, you know, just the art form itself, what he does, you know, it was going to elevate the entire project to have somebody of his caliber come aboard. But what did I tell him? I think it was a very impassioned, you know, speech that we got to do something that's never really been attempted before, but this is real. It's like, let me, you know, I remember I flew him out and just laid out all these documents, and just one by one, I was probably like, you know, my hands in the air, like I got some huge, like I'm running to become president myself, and I'm pitching this incredible, this story that's never been told before. And I think I was getting through to him, but I didn't know him at the time, so I wasn't quite sure if it was, you know, if he was absorbing it or if he was thinking I was crazy, but it's probably a better question for him.
Well, AJ, there's a quote in the afterword of this book that says fiction does a better job of telling the truth than nonfiction, I guess. So is this a true story that you're telling in a fictional venue?
Well, I mean, Tom and I talk about this a lot. Obviously, there are a couple of different kinds of truth, and for me as a storyteller, part of the truth that I'm trying to tell is a very human one, because my first connection when I'm writing a novel is about characters. It's about the stories that people actually experience, and trying to get the truth of that down. Now, as far as the truth of the larger story in more sort of objective sense, That's partly where Tom comes in. That he's relaying information to me all the time based on the people that he's talking to, and I'm working to incorporate that as best I can. And then, and as people then read the material, they were fact checking, and they were running interference to make sure that what we were saying was consistent and was in accord with all the best evidence that we had. And there are moments in the book that are, you know, that are based around very clearly documented things, you know, events and things that, well, in one case, there's actually a story of something that happened directly to me, which I put in and remembered in the terms that I experienced it, put it in the book.
Which story is that?
It's actually the narrative is divided into the four main characters, and each one has a sort of running, alternating story all the way through the book. But those narratives are interspersed with what we called interludes, just little moments that have come from outside their particular those four characters' story, things that come from history or for other kinds of documentation. And the first one in the book is an encounter, a sighting from an ordinary person who happens to be in Japan in the late 80s and sees something strange, and that person was me.
I noticed you have you had a chapter on Wilfred de Brouwer and the sightings in late 1989 there. There was one on Betty and Barney Hill. There was a short chapter on Admiral Richard Byrd. So you intersperse those things with the activities of your characters. I thought it was a nice touch. Also, it reminded me of Close Encounters, how you bring it starts with these disparate characters all over different parts of the world, and then the threads of the story bring them all together. And you bring them together, I don't want to give away too much, but my state of Nevada has a heck of a lot to do with it.
That's right. That's right. One of the challenges, I think, when Tom and I first started talking about the book, and he was saying, you know, I want to cover this period and things happening all over the world. And for me as a novelist, I'm thinking, okay, how the hell am I going to make that work as a single narrative? And we sort of hit on the idea of weaving those four main stories together, but that to make the narrative feel coherent, to get a sense of unity and progression towards a particular end, it made sense to try and somehow bring all of those four stories into a single timeline and a single place. And in the process also to for the chapters to start getting shorter and shorter and more surprising and more action-driven as the narrative sort of builds to a climax.
And Tom, I want to throw something in, too.
Sure.
This worked to my advantage when I started meeting the people within the government, because I was explaining how we would insert important information. And the genius of what AJ was able to put together was that each character is learning something on their own journey. So, you know, we have a pilot that gets promoted to what he doesn't understand is a civilian program, even though it's kind of being run by the government military, or, you know, there's another lady that is, her father is a world banker, and she has to take over his duties and understand that he was privately financing these weird aerospace companies. And you know, you go through all these characters, but they each have to learn something. And the reason that worked really well when I met the people within the government was I was able to say, you know, as we put information that has never been out there into these stories, then the people reading them and the viewers of the feature films and the television series and however we put it out there will learn the stuff step by step with the character, so we won't throw too much on somebody's lap that scares them. Because frankly, the stuff that I've gotten over the past 2 months that we're going to be putting in book two is some pretty scary stuff, you know, and so it really worked to our benefit to let it all go forward with the support of these people.
So you started with one book in mind, and it changed in the course of writing it because of these encounters and you had with real people who were telling you things that you didn't know before.
Right. Well, we knew, you know, AJ and I knew we were going to do at least, you know, three books, but we didn't know what they would have in it. You know, we just tackled this first one. We knew the scope of this subject matter. We had ideas of how we wanted to kind of lay it out on a macro level. But I will say absolutely 100% that the communications that I'm getting now is going to give us far and away most of the material. You know, for book number two, you know, we're going to be getting into the oceans. We're going to be getting into viruses. We're going to be getting into a lot of different stuff. But AJ is going to be able to sit down and through all of this madness, have it make sense and be palatable. And that's thank God that he's here with us.
AJ, let me ask you this. I mean, people study this topic for decades and they still don't get their heads around it. I'm one of them. You know, I can imagine the learning curve for putting something like this together. It's pretty steep.
It is. And that was the one thing, you know, I think Tom and I started talking about 18 months ago or so. And initially, that was the thing that I found hardest, just to get started. You know, as you say, there's a lot to learn. Tom was sending me books. He was sending me, you know, links to documents online, the YouTube videos, all kinds of stuff. And I was getting a bit overwhelmed. And again, you know, trying to then find a way to turn that into a single coherent narrative that would work as a novel, right, as well as, you know, a documentary. So you've got multiple challenges ahead: synthesizing the material, learning the material, turning it into a book that ordinary people are going to find entertaining as well as compelling. And I remember getting close to the end of year before last, and thinking, oh my God, okay. So I've got it. So the first chapter I'm writing, and I was committed to, was this. Putting myself in the position of a fighter pilot over Afghanistan, and that's no picnic, you know. Writing when you're not a fighter pilot who has experience flying over Afghanistan, you know, just getting into that mindset and knowing exactly what it's like to be in a plane, and, you know, make it feel like it's absolutely real. And Tom had said this thousand times, it's got to feel real. We're telling a really important story, and it's got to feel absolutely compelling. So, you know, it was a huge amount of research, and then I still found myself, you know, getting on the phone with fighter pilots and saying, okay, and then what do you do, and how do you make the plane do this, and how, you know, all that sort of stuff, and getting them to vet what I was saying, so that it was working, and it was still nerve-wracking to send the first 10,000 words or so to Tom and say, am I in the ballpark? Is this what you're looking for?
You know, one of the scenarios, again, without giving the whole thing away, but we discussed the idea of cover-up and the government cover-up, and of course there is no the government. There's a great big apparatus. One hand often doesn't know what the other is doing. For a subject like this, the chances are, and you and I can get into this later, Tom, but the chances are the people who really know the big picture, you can almost count them on your fingers. You guys have a plot device in there where it's private money outside the government that funds sort of some of the stuff that's going on there, which is sort of the scenario that I've come to believe is probably true, that whatever hardware might exist, it would make sense that it would be outside the purview of government, that some people within government might know about it, but that it would make sense to take it out of government into private hands or another government's hands or somewhere where FOIA couldn't be used, something like that. Was that how you intended to do it all the way along, Tom? Is that scenario?
It is, and I think, you know, for people that look into this subject long enough, they're going to see some threads that have been around for a very long time. I mean, one of the threads is, you know, that when the first crashes happened, we pulled together intelligence, military, and private industry, and we brought those brightest minds together and said, what do we do, and how do we attack this? And one of the things we do to this day is big private companies, or even publicly traded companies, but they're still not government companies. You know, it's still not like the military isn't building their own craft somewhere. They use really, really incredible minds at big public or private companies, but they're still kind of operating underneath the Department of Defense. But they're not really a part of the government, but they're doing their own thing, but what they're building they don't really own. You know, it's a really interesting way of how it works. I was amazed when, you know, I have a group out of the 10 advisors that I have, three of them are of the brightest scientific and engineering minds in the entire military-industrial complex. These are the guys that work, you know, 9 months out of the year, they work over at Area 51, you know, and that's the truth. And to learn kind of how things are, it's it's so different than what you come up with by reading just all these dumb conspiracy blogs your whole life, which we've all fallen into if you like this stuff, because where else are you going to go? But they might be building something that truly is, has anti-gravity, but they don't own it, even though they're paying for it, and it's theirs, kind of, and it's their own building, but the building's on government land, but it's just really, it's kind of convoluted, but it's an interesting dance, and I feel like I'm a kid that's walking in a museum and he's just blown away by every little painting on the wall, you know, and I'm trying to be respectful and not keep asking, you know, too many absurd questions, but I'm hoping that people realize what we're doing is real, and it's going to make its way into these books and into the films, and you're going to learn a whole lot.
AJ, using the novel as the approach, as the venue for telling this part of the story, it also allows plausible deniability for the people who are guiding Tom and giving you information via him as proxy. It allows them to say, well, this is just fiction. You know, don't take it too seriously, if that's what they want to do, while at the same time guiding the structure of the story.
Exactly. I think you're right. Yeah, it's a great way. And you know, your reference before to Close Encounters is a good one, because that's a story about people experiencing this phenomenon exclusively from the outside. And we wanted a blend of that with the exploring of people who are increasingly on the inside of the story. But as you say, ultimately, everybody is shaped by, it's a novel, right? It's a work of fiction. So, yes. I think, you know, Tom can speak to this perhaps more directly, but we were constantly being presented with information where we felt we were being led in very particular directions, but there was that House of Cards type line, if you know the original British TV show, where they would say, where somebody would say something and the minister would say, well, you might think that, but I can't possibly comment. And that's their way of saying, yes, that's exactly what's going on, but I'm not going to tell you officially.
Is there anything that Tom shared with you, or you learned as part of this learning curve, that you said to yourself, I'm not buying that. I don't believe it. I'm not going to write it. It's just too much for me.
I think, you know, I, as an academic, I'm trained to be skeptical. And I think we definitely had our Scully moments here and there where I would sort of put the brakes on a little bit or ask different kinds of questions. And I think, you know, there were moments when we got into some of the sort of Ancient Aliens type thing where I was saying, well, I don't know that I buy that. I was trained in part as an Egyptologist. I worked a little bit as an archaeologist before I became a Shakespeare professor. And so I know a little bit about things like hieroglyphs. So when people say, look, there's a hieroglyph representing a UFO, I can look at that and say, actually, no, I don't think that's what it is, and here's why. And I understand how the grammar of this works, and that's not what this would be doing. So, you know, whenever we ran into something that, well, we weren't in agreement, I think we backed away and said, well, okay, so let's push it into an area where we are much more sort of on the same page. And we're more sure of what we're saying because you want to be able to believe what it is that you're doing. I don't think there's anything in the book where I say I'm writing something that I actually believe to be false. You know, I don't think that's the case at all.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. AJ Hartley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insight. I read the book. It's a wonderful read, and it's going to be a great movie, assuming that it is made into a movie. I want to thank you for joining us. We're going to be back with Tom DeLonge in a moment and get into the meat of this, who these people are he's been talking to, at least a general description. And if you wonder what he does when he's not chasing UFO mysteries, this is a song from his band Angels and Airwaves. It's called Tunnels. From 2014, a song called Ends of the Earth, the ethereal sound of Lord Huron. We're talking with musician Tom DeLonge, whose band Angels and Airwaves were heard a couple of minutes ago. He's sort of redirected and refocused much of his energies and his fortune into the pursuit and launching of a project called Secret Machines, a multi-platform project, films, documentaries, books, music, to explore the kinds of themes that we discuss on this program often And he's told us that he has a group of advisors within and without government who've been telling him things they say is the real truth about these mysteries. So the obvious questions, how do we know they're telling the truth? Are they leading him down the path? Are they giving him disinformation? How can he prove any of this stuff to be real? We're going to get into all that stuff in our upcoming segments here on Coast to Coast AM. Our thanks again to A.J. Hartley for joining us to talk about Secret Machines Chasing Shadows, the first novel in the series of books being launched under this multi-platform project that Tom DeLonge has been describing for us. Tom, let's get down to the brass tacks, though. You had this project sort of in mind before you met these guys, right?
I did. Yeah, I did. I didn't quite know how I was going to get the support that I wanted. I had ideas of how to start, but you know, I'm the kind of guy that's always sniffed out if there is an opportunity somewhere to push something forward that seemed difficult. You know, it's just looking for opportunities in everyday life, and I've had a few of those in this kind of category. But you know, in the foreword of the novel, so we've been talking about the novel. It's going to come out. It's, what is it, April 5th? It'll be everywhere. But you know, I sent a few versions out to people before to read it, but the foreword wasn't in there. But this book will have the foreword in it. I describe a series of events that started a lot of this stuff, and I think that is a pretty interesting story.
Well, let's get into it. You made this decision, and it's risky for you. I mean, I remember when you just making the decision at the announcement. All right, look, I'm done with Blink 182. There are people online that practically want to shoot you, and they were really mad. But I mean, it's risky for you financially to do this. I mean, it's the Secret Machines is a big project. It's got to be financially viable, or it doesn't make it.
Yeah, you know, it's a real project. I have a company that needs the projects to work. You know, it's the whole thing is risky in many ways. I think we can even start back a little earlier. You know, there's going to be a teaser that launches here shortly that has some clips from the documentary side of things that I'm doing. And in it, there is a person that's silhouetted, that's been a very, very high-level defense contractor, an engineer, out at Groom Lake Area 51 for decades. And he says something in that teaser. But that person, long ago, I remember when I was telling him a little bit about what I wanted to do, he gave me a call the next day and called me on a video chat. So he gets on there and he goes, I made calls about you. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, I did. He goes, you better be really effing careful. If someone comes up to you and asks you to get in the car and go for a ride, don't get in that car. And I laughed it off, and I said, come on, man. I literally, it sounded like a movie to me, so I kind of just chuckled. And he goes, I'm being really effing serious with you right now. If someone comes by and asks you to go for a ride, don't get in the car. I am not effing around with you. And he's pointing at me. I'm being very serious. You're playing with some serious stuff, using different words, you know. And at that point, my heart was beating really fast, and I said, you're being very serious right now, aren't you? He said, yes, I'm being very, very serious with you, you know. And because of that conversation, you know, all the events that transpired after that, when I started meeting certain people, I went in very, very respectful and asked for permission on everything that I did, and treated it the way, you know, that these guys treat it, which is it is a national and global security issue.
Let's talk about the process of how you sort of pierce the veil, because that's what people are going to have trouble buying. How is it this rock star guy gains access to this when so many people, senators and researchers and scientists and spooks who've tried to look for this stuff couldn't find it? How do you get the access? Why? How do you explain that?
Well, let me might as well just tell you the story. So
yeah.
the first, you know, it spells this out a little bit in the foreword to the book, but I had an opportunity to go to an event. So the most classified and the most advanced group of engineers and scientists that work within the military industrial complex work under one specific group. And it's a very, very quiet group. But for the very first time, they were doing an event where family members can come and not go in the buildings, but at least celebrate in the parking lot what their loved ones do during the day, you know. And they asked me, you know, would you come up? And because I knew this one individual that told me to be really careful, you know, he goes, hey, look, this is a way for you to come up and see a little bit about what we're doing. And I said, oh, my God, I would love to. And he said, do you want to come and introduce the head of the company to the crowd? And I said, I will if I get to sit with him for 5 minutes. I don't know why I said that. I just knew that that was an opportunity that, you know, guys like me would kill, because I knew exactly who this group of engineers were. I knew exactly what they do, you know. So the head guy, are you kidding me? Yeah, lock me in a room with this dude. And so I got that opportunity. I went up and I did the introduction to the crowd, and then I got the 5 minutes to sit down alone and say whatever it was I wanted to say. So at that time, I didn't say anything about this subject. I just said, hey, I have an idea for a project. And this project, I think if it's done correctly, will reverse the cynicism that people have about government and what people have about the, you know, frankly, the military-industrial complex. I think that if I do this, you know, places like this and other arms of the government would be happy that it got communicated. But I didn't bring up anything that was, you know.
You didn't mention UFOs.
You don't mention UFOs. Don't even do that, because you'll get kicked right out of the door. You know? So he goes, okay, that's great. And I said, can I come up in a couple weeks and tell you more about it? Absolutely. So a couple weeks go by, then I come back up. I go through four layers of security. I go through machine guns, guys with machine guns, and then I get escorted into a very specific building that's with a bunch of buildings. This is somewhere out in the middle of the desert somewhere. And then I go through two layers of electronic code entry systems, and then you hear the lock go, you know, they make their sounds and the doors open up. Now I'm in a hallway, and that hallway has speakers lining the ceiling and just playing white noise, kind of like TV static. And that's there so you don't hear anybody's conversations. And the hallway also has a series of doors, and all the doors have kind of like those big rotary locks, like a safe lock on them. So we go through that hallway, and then they just twist the knobs on the doors, and then you hear the big sound, and that door opens up, and now I'm in the center of the building where the top three engineers work with the head of the company. And so I walk in, and they're sitting there, and they're ready for what it is I wanted to pitch them. So, you know, I'm nervously trying to figure out what I'm going to say. I had no idea that, you know, I had no plan for even bringing up UFOs then either. I was smarter than that. So we're talking, and one person apparently did a bunch of research on me and knew that I was all into the subject. So halfway through the conversation, this person says, so what about all the conspiracy stuff that you're into? And just, so now I'm being eyeballed by three very important people, and I'm just totally got caught, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do right now? So I tried to talk my way out of it, and then in comes the head of the company, the big dude, kind of saved the moment, but at the same time, you know, he got introduced to the conversation right at that point. So I said, you know, you come in at a very interesting part of the conversation. This person brought up, you know, the whole UFO issue with me. I just want you to know that I don't plan on, you know, treating that disrespectfully with this project. And then I got interrupted, and the head guy says, we cannot be involved with anything that has anything to do with that subject, especially since there has been absolutely no evidence whatsoever that it exists. So bam, I'm just cut off right there. And now my heart's racing, and I'm like, where do I do? So the only thing that I can think of at the moment is I said, well, Edgar Allan Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, is out telling all the young people of the world that this is real. So we have a credibility issue that we have to attack, but we don't have to attack it here or now, and we could talk this through. It's just something that young people think, and I want you to know a little bit more about my project. And so I got my way through. I was like, oh, my God, I'm still here. So they said, okay, continue. So that specific meeting ended, and then I just said, you know, hell with it. I said, sir, can I speak to you for 5 minutes alone? This is the Tom that even my old band members know of. You know, I'll just go for something. This is the punk rock kid inside of me, right? So, and he goes, sure. And so the other people kind of look at me weird, and they're like, okay, so we leave. And I kind of looked at them, so they did. So they stood up, and I shut the door. And now I'm in the middle of all these different layers of security, and I'm sitting with this person, I just go for broke. I just go, this is exactly what I said. I want you to understand something. And I sit down 2 feet in front of him, and he's staring at me in the suit. And I go, I understand the national security implications about what I'm about to say. I am not naive to the topic. I think if you hear me out, you're going to see that there's merit in what I'm about to propose. And he goes, well, what topic are you talking about? And I go, UFOs, sir. Now, this is what I want to try and do. And so then I just laid out this entire Secret Machines project idea. And I said, I'm going to send, and I said, but over the past 30 years, there's been a program to indoctrinate people to the idea that this might be real. But the problem is all the young adults of the world, they use the internet, they have iPhones, they talk to each other much quicker than people ever have. So this program that everyone's been following from the 50s is far outdated, it's antiquated, people have surpassed it, and now they don't trust you guys, now they don't like you guys, now they graduate from MIT and they want to work for Elon Musk, and they don't want to work here. Help me help you guys. And then he stops me, and because I said, frankly, there's been some bad things that have happened for the past 30 years on this subject, and he stops me, and I'm kind of going, okay, so now I'm in trouble. I just went right into this stuff. What's going to happen? And he looks at me, he takes a breath, and he goes, what kind of bad things has the government done with this subject? Very, very like calm and staring me straight in the eyes. And so I came up with a couple things that I can't say here. And I said, if you allow me to do this, what I'm trying to do, then I'm going to ask you for some help. I need advisors. I need people to help guide me so I don't keep disinforming people. I will not do that anymore. We need to tell the truth. And I just, you know what I said at the time? I said, you got to picture those little chickens running across the road and someone's guiding them. I'm that little chicken and I'm racing, but I don't want to get hit by a car along the way, you know? But it was no joke. There was nothing to laugh at during this time. So I said, I'm going to send you something. I want you to read it. And please, if you find anything about it good, you know, if there's any kind of merit in this at all, I would just respond any way you can, because I didn't think you could respond in an email or anything. He goes, okay, thank you for that. And then the meeting was done. So what I did was, the nonfiction books that we've been working on right next to the Secret Machines novel and parallel, it's a thesis of the UFO phenomenon. So I took the prologue to that thesis and I sent it to him. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, what did I do? What did I do? I shouldn't have sent in an email. Obviously, you don't send in an email. Every email you have with this group, it has all these, like, government, stamps all over the email because, you know, it goes through DOD servers and all this stuff. But I had no other way to get it to them, so I did. So I just sat there, and I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. I was like, okay, that relationship's done. I fried that thing. I went in there talking about, you know, I tell people it's like walking into somebody during World War II and say, hey, about that nuclear bomb you're building in secret, you know, I want to talk to you about that. That's basically what I did. Well, 2 weeks later, I get this email and it says, I want you to be next to the Pentagon at this date and this time. You're going to be meeting somebody from the CIA, basically. It said it in a different way, but I can't say what it said. And so I was like, oh my God, like it's working. So I get on a plane and I fly out to DC. And this is where it gets pretty sketchy, but it was insane. So I go to my meeting. I had to go to a very specific location that was within a rock's throw of the Pentagon. And I go to the back of a room at a certain location, and there's two guys in suits waiting at a table for me. So I go and I sit down at the table, and the person I was talking to is one of the persons. And he goes, I think this would be a good time for you to tell this person what you told me. And I'm sitting there kind of in my mind, I'm going, well, what do I say? Do I tell him everything I told you or some of the things? Am I allowed to tell him that I told you these things? Or I had no idea what to say. So I said, okay, I'll just go for it. So I went through the exact same pitch. So I talked for about 20 some minutes because they were just eyeballing me like hawks, you know? So at this point, I just don't know. I've never been in these situations before, so I didn't know if I was saying the wrong thing or not, but I was just trying to be very respectful, and I went through with it. And I finished my speech, and the person is just staring at me. I mean, these squinting eyes, you know, the beard, the suit. I mean, looks exactly straight out of a movie, an espionage movie. Takes a breath and goes, "Things like this don't happen at the White House. They don't happen at the Hill. They happen in places like this, at tables like this, where a few men get together and decide to push the ball down the field." And then the meeting was done. I mean, done, like a movie done. So the very next day, I got sent over to NASA. And I'm at the highest levels at NASA. I decided to do the same thing where I ask everyone to leave. So I did the pitch one more time, and they said, "You need to meet somebody." So that person flies out to San Diego. I go to another meeting. We get on a conference call, and this person is a very important in the military. Can't say which branch, but the highest level of ranks. But then after they left that particular branch of the military, they did something very, very important for another agency. And that person says, "Come fly and meet me up here in San Francisco." So within the next 48 hours. So I got on a plane and I go there. And now I'm sitting on a NASA Ames. NASA has three divisions. There's Ames Research, JPL, and then just NASA, the traditional NASA that everyone knows. I'm at Ames Research Center. And I go through my whole pitch again, and this person stops me and goes, "I just want you to know I'm a skeptic on this stuff." And I said, "I understand that, sir, but I knew you would say that, but let me just continue and tell you what I'm trying to do." 20 minutes later, "I just want you to know I'm a skeptic." And I go, I know you are. You already said that, you know, and I keep talking. And by the time I got to kind of concluding what this project would be, he just staring at me, and then he takes a deep breath and says, "Introduce him to the general." And then I was like, "Well, who's that?" And they're both just staring at me because there was this guy that was right next to him, a very serious guy. And I all of a sudden, on my email 2 hours later, I'm talking to somebody that has changed the entire course of this whole project. So I get on the phone with that person that same evening, and I go through the same situation. So I'm starting to walk through what I'm trying to do and how I plan to do it. And this person goes, "I want you to know I'm a skeptic on this stuff." And I go, "Sir, I knew you would say that, but let me explain a little bit more." So I walk through it again, and then the person goes, I just got to say it, I'm a skeptic." You know, it was verbatim. They all do it. But on the third time, he goes, "I swore an oath to my country." And I said, "Sir, I know you did. And I'm not asking for you to give me classified information. I don't deserve it. But I think if you understand what I'm about to do with this project, you may think it deserves your attention." And then he goes, "I'm afraid what you might find is a bunch of men in suits standing around an elephant." And I said, I was afraid you were going to say that, but can you help me?" And he says, "Fly out and meet me." And that's
where things get interesting.
This is where things get interesting. So I fly out.
I'll tell you what, Tom, we're going to take a break here in a minute. So you're about to get into some really good stuff. We're going to save it to the other side. I should say that without giving too much away, you and I had some conversations along the way, too. And I heard your pitch evolve, and it got pretty good. I mean, after a while, you got pretty practiced at it. And maybe we'll hear a little bit more about the pitch in the next segment, and then you can tell us about the general. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.